I don't know very many data analysts, data engineers, data scientists who some part of them doesn't feel a sense of ownership of their reports and insights. They don't want to just kick out a memo or a brief. They want to be involved in the decision-making process. And part of that, being invited to that table, I think, is remembering that data is always secondary to the real decision-making that's going on. And that's just another way of saying that data is always secondary to the human element. It's always secondary to human ingenuity.
The Digital to Learn podcast is dedicated to exploring both what's new and what's good in the use of technology in teaching and learning.
Our mission is to have the best minds sitting in front of our microphones sharing evidence-based strategies for digital teaching and learning.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
Thank you for joining us. And now, the Digital to Learn podcast.
Welcome to the Digital to Learn podcast. This is Brad Garner, and I'm here with my co-host, Tiffany Snyder. Welcome, Tiffany.
Thanks, Brad. It's great to be here.
And we have an amazing guest today. That would be Mitchell Culver. Mitchell Culver is the founding manager of the Center for Analytics at Utah State University. He is a thought leader in the field of analytics and a champion for student success that can best be fostered through increased intentionality among faculty, staff, and executives. Mitchell has degrees in psychology, music, and experimental research, as well as a PhD emphasizing research in higher education. His research has appeared in Popular Science, Slate, Smithsonian, The New York Magazine, and internationally on Radio BBC. He offers courses in music psychology, learning sciences, diversity, change leadership, and analytics. An honorary appointment as a visiting scholar at the London South Bank University has allowed him to enjoy ongoing research in the UK about institutional effectiveness and student well-being. His prominence in the field has also allowed him to serve as an analytics and change management consultant for universities across the nation and the globe. We'd like to welcome to the Digital to Learn podcast, Mitchell Culver. Welcome, Mitchell.
Thanks so much, Brad. Really happy to be here.
Glad to have you with us. Now, we'd like to begin this conversation with some completely ridiculous questions. And Tiffany's going to kick that off for us.
Yeah, and this first question does look ridiculous. The question is, analyze data or get a free all-expenses-paid vacation at a destination of your choice?
Is that even a question? I'm not sure.
I'm confused. Brad, you want to chime in?
Well, I'm sure he's going to pick data. I mean, I can't imagine him picking anything else.
No. I'm going to gather data on the beach. The view of the sunset, how much I'm enjoying my drink, how little my children are bothering me because they're out playing in the sand. And I would take the free vacation every time.
Okay.
So where exactly is that location?
You know, it's funny. I travel to Europe quite a lot. And if given a free vacation, I would go to London, despite having been there quite often. I can't get enough of that city. And partly it's the food. It's partly the people. I like just the vibe of London. But I joke about being on a beach, but it would actually be on the tube car that I'd be yelling at my kids, telling them to stop bothering the locals.
Okay. Would you rather read the book or watch the movie?
So interesting. That's a good question. Throughout my life, people have always mistaken me for a reader. I am pretty erudite. I know a lot of different things about the world and can talk pretty freely about those things. And so people assume I've read a lot, but I am definitely a watch the movie kind of person. I will always watch the movie over reading the old book.
And do you have some favorite movies?
I do. I have favorite actors and actresses. So anything with Whoopi Goldberg or Dustin Hoffman, sign me up. I'm on board with that.
Excellent choices. Excellent.
Would you rather be an unknown superhero or a famous villain?
That's a good question. I think, you know, the funny thing about working in higher education is it's like a tantamount to being an unknown superhero. Because the pay is never that great. We're really trying to change the world. And so I guess I've already made my choice. Unknown superhero. But I'm not alone. There's a whole cadre of faculty and staff and administrators in higher ed who are doing this hard work of student success and often are not as acclaimed as they deserve to be. So
absolutely.
Well, after
correct.
This podcast, you're going to be so known.
I hope so. That's right.
After this podcast, you'll be a famous villain. Is that, that's what you're trying to say, Tiffany?
No, it's not what I'm trying to say.
Okay, last question, thankfully. Would you rather talk like Yoda or breathe like Darth Vader?
Talk like Yoda, I would.
Okay. Could you do your best Yoda for us?
Oh, no. I don't have Frank Oz in my psychology. I can't. Nope. I can't do Miss Piggy either, coincidentally. For those who know, Miss Piggy and Yoda are voiced by the same individual.
They
seriously?
Are?
Seriously?
Yeah, Frank Oz. Yeah, seriously.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Brad, you look a little like Frank Oz. You should look into this.
I think I will.
Yeah.
Okay, now we're going to get really serious and philosophical and thought-provoking. Tiffany, take it away.
That was a lot of pressure. Your current role focuses on the use of data to inform decisions. How and when did you first realize the value of data in a higher education setting?
So that's a really good question. And I have to think back to when I was in graduate school, because I had majored in psychology and music as an undergrad. And I just kind of was trying to get through. I was more interested in human thinking and cognition and stuff. And then it wasn't until my master's program that I really had to get savvy with data and became a stats tutor in order to pay the bills in graduate school, because that's what was needed. And being a stats tutor, you kind of, there's a lot to know. And I had taken some classes, but I didn't remember everything. And so I started attending lectures with the students I was tutoring, so I could be sure to be on the same page based on what their instructor was sharing. And I remember one lecture was being given. It was about a standard distribution of means, so kind of a normal curve and this distribution of means. And there was a mean of that distribution. So that's the, you know, this mean of means. And I remember as the lecture unfolded, and I wish I could give you a synopsis that would do it justice, but as it unfolded, I remember kind of tearing up and being like, this is beautiful. Like, stats are beautiful. Like, I love this. And so it's kind of data nerdy, but then thereafter, I got into managing a student program, a learning program in the Learning Commons that was kind of tutoring for a whole bunch of the students at that university, Eastern Washington University. And the program's budget was $30,000. And I think the first time that I learned the value of stats in kind of informing decision-making was when I kind of had gone at the end of the year and I said, you know, we spent all $30,000, but I really think we could spend more. And here's the data to show that. Here's the data of the demand for the service. And the provost was a good guy. His name was Rex Fuller. And he said, okay, I'll give you 60. You know, we'll give you 60,000. We'll double it. And that was very generous. And so we took the 60 the next year. We spent every penny. And then once again, I was fastidious in kind of running the numbers to show not only the demand, but also to show the quality of that service. And so then I went back to the provost again at the end of the second year for that program and did the same thing. And I said, you know, I really think we could do more. What do you think? And he said, okay, I'll double it again. And so we had $120,000 just for that one program. I was the coordinator of that program. And just to give you a perspective, at some point I was talking with a colleague who ran the whole leadership office. She had a staff of like 13 employees and a bunch of students that worked for her. And and I said something. And I said, well, you know, we're up against this $120,000. She said, your budget's $120,000. I have a staff of 13 and our budget's $105,000. Like, how are you getting 120? I said, well, that's stats, that's data. You know, I've sold this service not only in terms of its quality, but I've sold it in terms of the demand and what it's doing for the students. And so that just left it with me. I mean, that early formative experience as a young professional left it with me that really, when you can tell a good story with a modicum of data, it really goes a long way in helping those who are stewards of an institution's resources. Gives them that confidence that you're gonna use that money well, and that in fact it is gonna serve its purpose. So So stats, I mean, has that kind of became a keystone for everything else that I've done in my career, is making sure that no matter what you do, always make sure that you're informing your decision making with those stats so that you can get the best return on that investment of time and energy.
So a little footnote for our listeners, if you ever need any extra money, just go to your boss and say, data indicates that I should have twice as much as I had before, and see how that works. And if it works, let Mitchell know.
Here's the thing. I do actually, I believe in this because I know that most individuals don't have demand forecasts mm-hmm. for their services. And most individuals don't have quality, like we had, in fact, we were one of the first programs to estimate a causal impact of tutoring on student performance in courses. And we came up with a very complicated design, method to demonstrate this causal estimated impact. And it hadn't been done before. We published off of that. And it was one of the first times that people kind of had that a paper, a scientific paper published, kind of showed, you know, academic tutoring, when it's run correctly, it actually makes an impact on student well-being. So I think it's funny you say that, but I do actually think that there are pockets of sanity in higher education where when you bring cogent numbers that really tell a clear story, you can make the money flow.
So you heard it here first. Mitchell Culver says there are pockets of sanity in higher education.
Oh my.
I chose my words carefully. It's only pockets. It's not widespread.
So you're a data guy, but from our conversations and hearing you speak, I know that you really care deeply about students. How do you connect those two things together?
Yeah, so it's funny because I have this line that I always have to introduce myself by saying, people think I'm a data guy, but in actuality, I'm in love with human potential. And I'm always surprised when I talk with colleagues. I was at a conference and exchanging with a colleague, and he said to me something I thought was very unusual. He said, you know, I hire these data analysts, and where I want them and where they're most valuable is back at their computer writing code. And he said, you seem to think that it's as valuable for yourself as an analyst to be out in and amongst the people and being diplomatic. He says, but what a waste of money. You should have the other people doing that who are not as expensive. And it was such a poignant moment to hear a person's perspective that is so kind of antithetical to the way I've built my career, which is that some of the most valuable work an analyst can do is to go and spend time in a diplomatic manner, translating those insights into action with those stakeholders, right? Because I don't know very many data analysts, data engineers, data scientists, who some part of them doesn't feel a sense of ownership of their reports and insights. They don't want to just kick out a memo or a brief. They want to be involved in the decision-making process. And part of that, being invited to that table, I think, is remembering that data is always secondary to the real decision-making that's going on. And that's just another way of saying that data is always secondary to the human element. It's always secondary to human ingenuity. It's always secondary to stewardship over student well-being in higher education. And so I think it was kind of a funny conversation, but I do think that the bridging of that gap is one of the ways that Utah State and the Center for Student Analytics that I oversee, that we've really made waves in higher education, is by making sure that we always come back to fulfilling those basic human needs of curiosity, of making sure that we're competent so that we can optimize, and also making sure that we collaborate so that the data isn't being interpreted out of context. And this is something I think, I mean, as deep as you want to go with this, the human element is the core of any organization. And we always are seeing people move away from that, which we try to advise against.
So your data really describes that human element. It really puts a face on it in some ways.
It does. And the other way to say it is that really great data is capable and, in fact, almost necessary for starting a really productive conversation. but it can never finish that conversation.
Mm.
It may get things going, but it's never sufficient to take it to its end. And taking it to its end is really rolling up your sleeves and getting to work. It's doing that hard work of collaboration, of planning, of thoughtful consideration of things that are not easily measured. There was a sociologist, Pierre Bourdieu, French, really great writer, and he developed what he called the economy of happiness. And in that kind of model, that philosophy, he said, it's fascinating how societies stop to realize that some of the things that we measure most often matter the least, and some of the things that matter the most can never be measured.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's always this, you know, this line that goes around in higher education of being data driven, but we always make sure to use the phrasing data informed, because there is this notion that some of the most important things can never be put into metrics and shouldn't even be attempted to be put into metrics, but still have to inform that leadership and that decision-making conversation that goes on at universities.
So do you think that reluctance is, I don't really want to know the answer, or I just don't know how to measure it?
Well, you're hitting, so the fact that you recognize that there are different sources of motivation for data denial, right?
Like, yeah.
We do see this. So I call these barriers of emotional resistance, and they are varied. There are many forms of barriers of emotional resistance. In part, some of it has to do with not wanting to do your homework. I'm surprised at how many administrators take for granted that they already know everything there is to know about whatever the topic at hand is. And so doing your homework means reading the latest literature, reading the latest press, collecting pilot data to see if there's some kind of way to forecast the way things may head. It's being a lot more deliberate and slowing down. So there's an emotional barrier to kind of doing your homework. I also think there's an emotional barrier to, like, data is mathy. People have this kind of like sixth grade math trauma that they've never gotten over. And so they kind of come into a situation and they're off put by even a slight amount of data makes them feel a little bit ill at ease. And you know, we know this about legislators. They've kind of done research as bills are being advocated for before legislative panels. There's research that's shown that the more data that is on display during those hearings, the less likely the legislators are to move in the favor of the data. They're less persuaded, but that just a modicum amount, just enough, right? Like a few slides of data in the right direction can win the day. And so the advice that lobbyists always receive is always have data, but never too much of it, right? And I think that's because this data is mathy kind of thing. People kind of tune out, don't they?
So does a good heart-wrenching story overcome the lack of data?
Well, I think it's a mix. I think a good heart-wrenching, so there again, it's never sufficient, right? A good heart-wrenching story can start a good conversation, but never really truly finish one.
Good point.
And I do think it is a balance. That data storytelling really is a balance between finding the stories that really quickly capture and succinctly capture what the data is saying anyway, but then also having the data to show that these are not isolated cases. We do this a lot in our advising statistics. We know there's an equity gap in most institutions advising where the most vulnerable students are being advised the least often. Mm. There's some different complex reasons for that. But when I go and try to convince people to do things differently to close that equity gap, I never miss the opportunity to tell a heartwarming story about an advisor who used some analytics to learn that there was a student who was especially vulnerable. And then it turned out this student had lymphoma, you know, recently been diagnosed with lymphoma, and was in that case, actually, it's actually really heartwarming. This advisor caught a hold of a student because of an analytics insight who had been diagnosed with lymphoma and who therefore was not as engaged in the learning management system as her peers. Met with a student, learned this. Another faculty member in that department had had the same kind of lymphoma as the student.
Wow.
And so they were able to make that connection and get the student the resources she needed to move through the remaining two semesters of her program. And unfortunately, the student's health declined and she passed, and her diploma was mailed on the day of her passing. Mm. And so you can imagine how meaningful it was for that student to know, as she kind of closed out her life, that she had overcome, she had finished, she had gotten and received the right resources. Of course, the point of the story is to say that if we can use data effectively, it can signal to us when a student needs to be sitting with us, or vice versa, we need to be sitting with a student. And so I think it's a both and, right? You want the compelling story. You also want to be kind of mindful of the overarching data.
I just wanted to say that I haven't resonated with a guest more. Mitchell, this is very similar career path for me, and poles between an appreciation for statistics and psychology, but also just a desire to be around people and to advocate and be in a more communicative role. So it's so tempting for me to just take a back seat right now and listen and soak up everything you have to say. When it comes to statistics and data, it's easy for people to get intimidated. Our podcast is on technology and learning. And so for me, one of the things that has made data and statistics less intimidating and has found me actually loving it is just the technology at our fingers that makes it easier to navigate and to communicate about. So what are some of the ways that you utilize technology to do your work and the platforms potentially that you use, if you could share?
Yeah, so that's really great. So I was brought on into my current role as a system administrator for a suite of tools that's provided by a company in Austin called Civitas Learning. They do predictive analytics that signal when students are likely to leave an institution for things that might otherwise be mitigated through intervention. And so while I was brought on as a system admin, it was very clear that professional use of technology is a core competency of the 21st century skill set that you want professionals to have. And so early in the work, I was surprised to learn that people were still using paper to do degree planning and stuff like this. And also realized that technology has to be introduced through in stages, right? It won't be all adopted all at once, but that one of the ways that you showcase to folks why technology is so important is using that Everett Rogers diffusion of innovations curve. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but you kind of identify, here's some people who really are going to take to technology like a duck to water, and who realize its inherent benefits, who realize the efficiencies that grow out of the use of that innovative technology. And for them, it's very natural. And so they very early in the process of adoption, they go, oh, I get it. I know how to use this. It fits into my workflow very seamlessly. It kind of resonates with the work that I'm wanting to do with students, whether they're faculty, advisors, whoever it is, even administrators. They then become the model citizen for those other groups who are in various stages of readiness. There's a great book by Hal Kane and some others called The Technology Fallacy. And in that book, they talk about absorptive capacity, this idea that when it comes to technology, each organization only has so much capacity to take on that innovation. And so these early adopters really become these model citizens where you can showcase them. And in one iteration, we even paid a set of four or five people to kind of go around and do these showcase trainings of, I'm a typical everyday professional. I feel put upon just like you. A new technology was made available to me, and this is how I've seamlessly incorporated it into my everyday workflow. Here's some tips and tricks and ways to avoid pitfalls with this tech that you might consider. That was a really successful model and made people excited, because there is this need for vicarious experience, right? Not everyone is going to take to the tech like a duck to water. And that Everett Rogers diffusion of innovations curve really reminds us that whatever else people are, they're social and they are willing to run with the pack. But there's always those front of the pack leaders who kind of have to take on the stress of that early exploration in order to try to find where those pitfalls are and then signal to the others in the group, here's, you know, watch out for this, watch out for that, because you can get some good success with this technology, but you really have to be mindful.
It seems like those front of the pack innovators don't often look back to see who's following them. They keep looking forward.
Yeah. Right. Well, and this is partly why I say those barriers of emotional resistance are fairly legitimate, aren't they? I sometimes talk with colleagues who treat emotional resistance as if it's a pet peeve of theirs. Like, oh, these people who, even Everett Rogers calls the last group, he calls them laggards. And I moved away from that terminology in my own work. I much prefer the term like final adopters. Like, yeah, they're there. But a lot of times the barriers of emotional resistance are legitimate. Mm-hmm. People are trying to maintain a balance of all their expectations and all the resources that they have. They're constantly juggling and trying to, as any professional does, trying to maintain sanity in what they're doing. And then you're juggling all this stuff, and then and they have a balance. They finally figured it out, all the body English that's going to make this work.
Yeah.
And then now you're throwing a giant, you know, laptop into the midst of it. You juggle this too, or a new piece of software, juggle this too. Well, their emotional resistance is authentic. And so this idea of people looking back to see, you know, how is this being received, is one of the most important things that you can do. I did a lot of early listening sessions where I went around and spoke to people. And I kind of would joke, I would call these meetings and I would kind of joke with them. I said, if I had planned ahead of time, I would have brought with me a ski bag, and inside the ski bag would be a bunch of pool noodles. And then I've put this on the conference table here, and then we can spend the next 45 minutes of you beating me with these pool noodles, with all your complaints about this new software, this new initiative fatigue and technology fatigue. And I didn't plan. I don't have a ski bag full of pool noodles. But could we spend the next 45 minutes of you kind of emotionally unloading on me and ranting at me so that I can really understand where you're at with all this? Because this is a skill that I think most administrators don't have in their tool belt, which is a tool of having that big ear to go and listen to what may not be emotionally pleasant content, but is really valuable content if you're interested in being a good leader.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh, this is huge.
We've enjoyed talking with Mitchell Culver, and we know that you'll be back for the second half of this, so we'll see you then.
Thank you for joining us on Digital to Learn.
If you enjoyed this podcast, there are three things we ask you to do. One, come back and join us again. Two, tell your friends about us. And three, give us a positive ranking on your favorite podcast platform.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
It's a digital world.
Always keep learning.